Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, where the senior editors of your favorite 52-year-old political magazine assemble each Monday to do battle with the news. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy March, everybody!
Howdy!
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
To give you an idea of just how badly things are going here in New York, where I'm sitting, for the man formerly known as Preemptive Wince, the Love Gov, here's how my local news radio station started its broadcasts this morning. Quote, Andrew Cuomo is still the governor of New York this morning. This is not directly because of his disastrous mishandling of nursing home policy at the beginning of COVID, nor his straight up lying about nursing home stats and deaths and such, though those do come up as kind of supporting evidence when people talk about all the troubles. Cuomo is in the barrel right now, in fact, being called monstrous by prominent Democratic politicians in New York, because two of his former employees have both come forth to accuse him of sexual harassment. The second of those two, a 25-year-old woman, told the New York Times over the weekend that Cuomo last June, when they were alone in his office, quote, asked her numerous questions about her personal life, including whether she thought age made a difference in romantic relationships, and had said that he was open to relationships with women in their 20s, unquote. He also complained about not getting enough warm hugs. Cuomo has not denied her account, though he did deny the first set of accusations from a former economic development official who last week flushed out her allegations that she initially made in December, saying that between 2016 and 2018, Cuomo was grossly flirtatious, asked her to play strip poker, and found whatever excuse to like touch her back and stuff, and once in his office kissed her unwantedly on the lips. So obviously, Catherine, there is a ton of snark being passed around about this, including from our own Elizabeth Brown, who rightly headlined her piece this morning. Cuomo asks America to hold off on believing women this time. But I want to do kind of a gut check with you, which is this. Let's assume the 25-year-old is correct. Cuomo didn't deny it. And let's further assume that an investigation would confirm her version of events. Is it, in your point of view, a removable or a resignable offense for a government boss to ask kind of gross questions to a possible romantic target alone in his office without actually doing anything physical? What say you?
First of all, hi, happy Women's History Month.
Yep.
It's March 1st, so let's celebrate. I did a puzzle of tiny feminist cartoons yesterday with my daughter, so I'm good to go. I've done my work for Women's History Month, and I don't have to...
Why, you did it before we got to Women's History Month.
It's still on the table right now. It's like, we're, you know, which means that I don't have to answer your question directly, and I'm not going to, because, oh my God, the reason he should resign is because... like tens of thousands of people died unnecessarily on his watch. Like this is something that I actually have always struggled with. I both want to hold powerful people accountable for their bad behavior, especially toward junior female subordinates, because that seems like a thing that people are still struggling to figure out how to do properly. At the same time, if and when, please God, when Cuomo resigns, it better not be over this. It better be over the genuinely catastrophic consequences that his leadership has had, including deaths, unnecessary deaths. Like, I feel very bad for those women if he touched their backs inappropriately. And God knows people have touched the small of my back inappropriately in business context, and I have hated it and would like to roast them all. No, I'm not going to name names.
It wasn't me.
Face away.
It wasn't me.
But I would genuinely prefer to talk about his failures as a political leader. And, you know, we're going to talk about this stuff instead.
Well, we are going to talk about his failures.
We are not. I mean, the chattering classes, the discourse is going to talk about this.
I think that, you know, the charges against him are serious, especially in the context of New York, and his position there in the Democratic Party. But it's partly, we are talking about this because he's such a disastrous governor. And you know what's happening to him, and something analogous without the sex scandal or the harassment scandal rather affected his father when he was trying to run for his fourth term as well. I mean, people get tired, not just of Cuomo's, but of governors who have been in power for a long time without seriously advancing the, you know, health and welfare and economic strength of a polity. So Cuomo, you know, and it, I mean, what's fascinating and I think worth thinking about and looking at is the rapidity with, I mean, literally 3 months ago, maybe 4 months ago, he was, you know, putting out posters about how he had helped New York State, you know, summit Mount COVID and all of that. He put a book out. He won a
international Emmy. The best guy.
Yeah, you know, for his, yeah, I mean, I'm sure he won a couple of Golden Globes last night that nobody gives a shit about. But, you know, this is all of a piece that really is coming crashing down for him. And it's an agglomeration. And he's probably, you know, at least from his own point of view, he's probably removable or certainly not reelectable for any of the sins, real and imagined, that have been lobbed against him in the past time. But, you know, it's good to see a politician being held to account across multiple, you know, kind of sectors of behavior. But the serious, you know, I mean, it's not to minimize what's in the news right now, but his handling of COVID was terrible. I mean, it's really objectionable, you know, not criminal, I suppose. And it also opens up to how the press freaking covered this guy. You know, Matt, you, I think, called him the love gov, ironically. But, you know, he was trying to push that. People in the press were trying to push that. I mean, this is a good time for the press to relearn the idea that, you know, you're supposed to hold public servants accountable. You're not supposed to help project their images into every nook and cranny of your media market.
I would, as I do in these circumstances, draw a distinction between the local, the state and local press, which has been appropriately challenging to Cuomo for the most part, and the national media, which went looking for heroes and anti-Trumpies. And that's where most of the embarrassments took place. Peter, Nick says, you know, it's kind of good to see someone get a comeuppance. I want to pose the flip side of that. Is it good for the cause of, let's say, you know, advancing a better set of behaviors of gross old bosses in the workplace when these things seem to be like used as a club very opportunistically, when Cuomo is no longer useful politically, suddenly everyone is very excited about this and other behaviors? Doesn't that sort of diminish the principles underlying the kind of the root accusation?
I mean, I think Liz Nolan Brown's headline today gets at the diminishment of the principles that is going on here, which is that Democrats are the party of believe all women, right up to the point when the women are accusing prominent Democrats. Now, that's, to be clear, there are Democrats who are saying basically Cuomo needs to go because of this. And so it's not universal across the party, but Cuomo himself, who, you know, a year or two ago would have just absolutely, you know, fallen in line here, is saying, wait, let's hold on, let's gather evidence, let's not rush to judgment. And I think that's pretty telling. You know, like Catherine,
people have also touched the small of your back inappropriately. Yes.
That was me.
Like Nick, I think these charges are serious, and I don't think we should dismiss them. And I think we should take them seriously. And the biggest reason I think that they're serious, just besides the specifics of them themselves, is the word you keep using, Matt, which is boss. This isn't sort of some kind of vague, this person has power in a general way and therefore, you know, sort of is important in the world, and I'm less, you know, and the women in question are less powerful. This is a person who has the power to fire the people who were making these allegations. And that makes a really big difference to me, is that when it is your direct supervisor, when it is somebody who has the power to hire and fire you, that just makes these sorts of interactions very different. And we should take them very seriously. And then you combine that with the fact that this is happening in the public sector. This is, you know, these are major political, I mean, he is not technically a national leader, but New York is a giant state that has a huge influence on national policy, that has a lot of people in it, that has New York City, right? That sort of, in some ways, the kind of one of the cultural capitals of the country. And so someone in that, yeah, sorry, Matt, I know you live there. Maybe you disagree. It's also got you, right? And so someone in that kind of position and someone who has the power to fire these people, that makes a big difference to me. I also just think it is in some ways satisfying to see Cuomo get some comeuppance here. I mean, this guy in October of last year published a book titled American Crisis: Leadership Lessons from the COVID-19 Pandemic. You guys may notice
he's got great material for the paperback
edition. Right, like I wish you know, if that book had been a retrospective on the pandemic that was over, then, you know, that would have been one thing, but like the thing was written, I mean, it had to have been written in like March, April, and June, and then just rushed to publication. And he was just taking a victory lap before there was, first of all, when he had lost specifically thousands of lives, but also before there was any victory to be had for anyone. And it's just kind of absurd how the arrogance, the braggadocio of him and his persona. And the way I think that sort of plays into the allegations that we are seeing come up now. I do not have a whole lot of love lost for Cuomo here.
Two quick points, though, too, is that he denies the allegations, particularly the ones made by Lindsay Boylan, who a former aide who's running for city borough president. That's important. But what is also interesting about her charges are that she actually said that he exists without ethics was one of her phrases, that he takes advantage of people and he ran a toxic team environment. And on a certain level, irrespective of the sexual harassment or the sexual dimension of the charges, all of that comports very strongly with Cuomo's public profile, going back to when he was part of his father's campaign for the governorship against Ed Koch and is widely understood to be the author of a bunch of homophobic slogans that were circulated kind of in subterranean ways by the Cuomo campaign against Ed Koch through his time in the Clinton administration. I mean, Andrew Cuomo I can say this as an Italian American, he has acted as a mafia don. He is John Gotti Jr. He is Donald Trump Jr. He inherited a seat, and he is an ugly, horrible human being by almost every measure of people who deal with him on a regular basis. And that's part of this, too, because
we just spent four or five years talking about why character matters in politics. And this is why character matters in politics.
Catherine, is not one of the lessons here. And Elizabeth Nolan Brown does a great job of listing some of the policies that Cuomo has backed as governor, which we've written about previously, many of which, put the government kind of in charge of figuring out the intent of interactions between males and females. Is not one possible takeaway from this that maybe we should slow down and yes, pay attention to due process in this and other cases of everybody?
Yep. Team due process always. I mean, this is Cuomo, I suspect, will rediscover his commitment to due process, as people tend to do as soon as one of these things engulfs them. But I think, there are two sides of that. And one is a thing that I sort of alluded to earlier, but want to hit a little harder, which is that it is not a good system for us to dispose of disfavored people, whether for good or bad reasons, from our institutions by hitting them when they are weakened with either a Me Too claim or a claim of racism. This is not a good system. And I do think that this is more and more a thing that's happening. And it's certainly at least part of what's happening with Cuomo right now. Now, maybe it's not all of it. Maybe there are other reasons why these charges are coming out now and being entertained in the public sphere right now in a more serious way. But I think there is absolutely an emergent pattern where we are using women's allegations against powerful men or people of color's allegations against powerful men as the cudgel to take down people who were already in disfavor. And that's bad for everyone. We should take down people who are in disfavor, for instance, for forcing people with COVID back into nursing homes by litigating that, by fighting that fight. We should not, absolutely not, just say like, oh, let's let a couple of women do the legwork here instead of doing proper investigation.
Please.
The GAMS
the
work,
GAMS
the
work.
Jello
the
on
GAMS
springs
work.
Work, the
getaway sticks,
getaway sticks work. I was opening it up for Matt, but he was too slow.
Yeah,
that's bad process. And you know, I think to their credit, national Democrats are trying really hard to say something that sounds consistent right now about Cuomo, while not actually doing the thing of kicking him out. And that is more than they have tried in the past. So I guess I will give Dems a little bit of credit for that. They are at least saying the words, this needs to be investigated. They are at least saying the words, believe women, in many cases, whereas I think even 2 years ago, they wouldn't have said those words or believed the import behind them.
Nick, speaking of
Matt Welch,
Matt Welch, and also speaking of, you know, punishing politicians for the right reasons, you are sitting, as far as I know, in the Golden State of California, where there's a recall effort of being.
Matt, you know, there's a lot of tarnish on this Golden State. Let me tell you, I don't even know if gold can be tarnished.
You know,
but,
Nick, there's a whole sunshine noir dialectic.
Yeah,
and just,
there really
you know,
is, yeah.
The dark, the dank underbelly. Anyways.
Oh, speaking of dank, so I suspect that means Gavin Newsom is about to appear.
Yes. So Gavin Newsom is about to appear. He is facing a recall election for his.
Hello, dankness, my old friend.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. For mostly for, although Nick can correct me if I'm wrong, it's mostly for his mismanagement during the pandemic. Although I presume there's always a wildfire mismanagement associated with it, or water rights. It's all about water, Nick. Really, it's the transfer.
Yeah.
It's
that,
the
riparian rights.
I've seen that movie. I've seen the movie by Roman Polanski about water in Southern California, but I don't talk about it anymore.
No,
Matt Welch.
No,
because Roman Polanski made Pirates, and you know, then that closes out all discussions of him.
And among other things, Newsom was caught again inside a restaurant again on his own stupid TikTok.
His defense of like, I didn't eat there. Like he's like standing next to a table covered with like crumpled napkins and like empty dishes. And he's like, but maybe I didn't. Do you have proof I ate there? And it's like, dude, you were in
you're
a restaurant for an hour.
This is you want to get AJ Weber.
And also
start going
in Fresno. Who knew Fresno had restaurants? Just kidding, Fresno. You know, I love you.
That's
you know
the raisin capital
you.
Of the world, Matt Welch.
It
come on.
It absolutely is. Close to the capital of the world. Lindsay, olives, Gilroy, garlic. I know them all, people.
What words are you saying?
Yeah.
I don't know what's happening.
Yeah, Matt,
right now.
I was just having a stroke.
Is this one of those
I
free
think,
association
Matt's
tests?
Having a stroke.
Let's all say words.
Either that or he somehow is communicating with his bondage mistress
man,
or something.
Woman, camera. What? Okay.
Listen,
garlic, olives.
I just want to know what cocktails and wine were served at the dinner that he
Peter,
didn't have.
Is there a martini that uses like a clove of garlic instead of an olive or an onion?
So I don't know of one that uses garlic, but I can imagine a way to do that. However, I have been experimenting with a black truffle oil infused martini recently, and it is amazing.
Do you have a newsletter that I might subscribe to?
Indeed, it's called cocktailswithsuderman.substack.com, and I'm going to talk about that particular
drink. I find it hard to believe that name was available.
Let's pivot back to the former Mr. Kimberly Guilfoyle. Nick, how's the love for Newsom out there in California?
Yeah, you know, when you think about California state governance, it's kind of like, you know, Cuba during the height of Fidel Castro's regime or, Venezuela with Chavez, like it there, you can't imagine an alternative, but you know, someday this man will die and will be removed from power. Right. I mean, no, it's just because this is a super democratic state. I mean, and by that, I mean, like a super majority at every level. Like, you know, the Democrats get 10 votes for everybody else. And so weirdly, he's part of the landscape, even as a massive recall effort is underway. And I think, you know, shows serious, you know, intent and possibilities to, you know, at least bring something to a vote. About Newsom before his term is officially up. The people that I have talked to, and, you know, admittedly, because I really, you know, how many people do you meet during lockdown and stuff like that? But nobody is happy with him. And what's interesting is that as much as the COVID lockdown things, and he, you know, California had the first, you know, shelter in place or stay in place rule in the country statewide. He's gone arbitrarily back and forth in terms of opening things up, shutting things down, exerting a lot of power over that. But people are as pissed about the economy and kind of the, you know, the idea that California is losing people as well as jobs, as well as everything to other states such as Florida and Texas. And, you know, I think, Matt, I'll, you know, as somebody who was, you know, born in New York and then moved to California and also spent time in Texas. I have been slowly drifting, chasing the place where the center of American culture and dynamism goes. And, you know, New York hates California and Texas and Florida because they are the next thing, or they were the next thing. California very much feels to me like a state that knows it is on the downward side of having been the dominant power, you know, kind of cultural force, economic force, mythological force in America. And I think it's going to be Gavin Newsom is going to be seen as one of those, you know, despite his movie star leading man looks and Pat Riley slick back hair, he is going to be seen as one of those fat load presidents, you know, in the late 19th century who presided over, you know, a period of American history that nobody really cares about. Like he is clearly and unequivocally seen as part of the problem at this point.
There was a great passage in The Guardian in a piece about the recall effort that just said, Newsom was elected in part because California's Democratic majority wanted the state to lead the resistance against the Trump administration. Now with Biden in office, Newsom needs to prove he can achieve on some of his ambitious promises and navigate a challenging COVID recovery. They literally elected the guy just to be like an anti-Trump pundit. And this is a problem with Cuomo as well, in some sense, right? Like, it's not like these weren't the only reasons, but these were big parts of the reasons that these guys were successful and popular. Their constituency was, please be the voice of the resistance for us. And then it turned out that they were actually terrible governors who just didn't deliver on the stuff that governors need to do. And this is something, you know, sort of to go back to Catherine's point about how we're using a bunch of other issues to kind of navigate to get rid of inconvenient people. Voters need to be more focused on the mechanics of governing. And that's true at the presidential level. It's true in the Senate. And it's very much true when you are electing the governor of one of the biggest states in the country.
I think that's understood about Newsom at this point, who has a bunch of sex scandals in his past that he's, you know, atoned for and whatnot, I suppose. But he is unpopular, I think, largely because of his policies. And there is a recognition, not always articulated as such, that he is not doing what would allow California to kind of really come back and start sending off a gravitational pull to as Matt started this segment, to the Golden State.
Catherine, as a part of a feature that I'm overdue to deliver to you, I looked at the job loss statistics from February of last year to the end of December, which is the closest that we have. So it's basically, you know, what percentage of jobs have each state lost during the pandemic? And just a startling discovery when you sort of put numbers in a certain order. The top 18 states for percentage of job loss, led by Hawaii, which has actually the lowest death rate of COVID of any state, But they've lost the most jobs, 13.6%. The top 18 states have one feature in common. Every one of those states voted for Joe Biden. The bottom 18 states for job loss, including two that gained jobs, Utah and I think Idaho or some damn place, are all governed by Republicans and have unified Republican governance of the state house. It's crazy. Like there's, you look at the actual death numbers, they're basically the same in both blocks. Leads me to think in terms of a bunch of different things, but like the one of the policy knockoffs, if we're talking about, you know, look at policy instead of your national narratives, like, could it just be that state and local governments run by Republicans do a hell of a lot better during pandemics for their economies than the damn Democrats, Catherine?
I mean, this is my answer, my grudging answer to the question of how can you, a libertarian, still sometimes have good things to say about the Republican Party even after Donald Trump? Like, this is the answer. It's that somewhere in the ghost of the Republican Party's morals is a commitment to economic freedom. And it's not, it is not consistently realized. I don't know how to say it like even more vehemently, like, holy moly, is the Republican Party constantly failing to embody the value of free markets? Yes. Is the Democratic Party also constantly failing to embody its own values? Yes. But stuff like that, stuff like the thing you just described, is why I cannot bring myself, as a libertarian who doesn't vote, who does not register as a member of any party, to fully abandon the idea that there is something to work with somewhere in the American GOP for people who share my values about economic liberty. And it's a mess, and it is hard to find. But that thing is why I am unwilling to say we have to write off the Republican Party completely.
Peter, you're from Florida. They have or are having the Conservative Political Action Conference down in Florida instead of its usual slot in the Potomac area. And the person who came in second place in the straw poll voting there was your own favorite governor, Ron DeSantis, who has sort of become a poster boy both for lovers and haters of Republican kind of COVID policy. As someone who, and he's also been, like, you know, oftentimes in the national media compared very unfavorably to the aforementioned governors Cuomo and Newsom. Tell us a thing about Ron DeSantis and what that might say about the future of Republican politics that he is at this point prominent.
There have been a number of pieces and videos, including one by folks with Reason TV, comparing Florida and California's outcomes versus their lockdown policies. And in many ways, Florida has done just as well, if not even better, than California, despite much less restrictive policies. I think the sort of more general thing that I would say here is that coming out of this awful year of just unprecedented public health driven restriction on economic and individual freedom, especially in big blue states like California and New York, but not just in those states. I think the very specific policy lessons are still a little murky and are going to be somewhat unclear for a long time. So you have Governor Kristi Noem, for example, bragging that she's never shut anything down. And then you have Scott Gottlieb pointing out that, in fact, their death rates were just higher. And that was a result, most likely, of, or that seems to be correlated, I should say, with states that that shut fewer things down. And so the kind of the very specific policy lessons, I think, are going to be somewhat unclear, and there's going to be a big argument over them. But the thing that I think I'm most comfortable saying right now, and that I think we have certainly learned, is that broad-based lockdowns of the sort that California imposed early and for much longer than any other state simply don't work. They don't help with the public health case, and they destroy your economy in the process. They drive your constituents crazy. And I mean that in a colloquial sense, but also just in a it's pretty clear that there are mental health crises going on across the nation, but especially in the kind of big blue state populations where people have just been living really strange and restricted and weird lives for a year now. And California is absolutely at the forefront of that. And Newsom's application of those rules has made them even worse, because business owners and individuals on a week-to-week basis have no idea if the things they're allowed to do this week are going to be in place next week. And so, you know, I have read story after story, and we have pieces coming up at Reason just talking about how business owners have tried to weather this. And, you know, they'll find out, oh, we're a restaurant, and we're told that, you know, you're probably not going to be able to do indoor dining, but if you want to set up something outdoors, that's probably going to work. And in fact, all the evidence shows that outdoor, there was a Zeynep Tufekci, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, piece in The Atlantic over the weekend, just noting that there has not been a single documented case of a super spreading event outdoors anywhere in the whole world. And so, you know, business owners in California spent tons and tons of money setting up outdoor spots for people to eat, and then found out in some cases just a week or two later, oh, wait, we're closing that down again. And yet there were film crews across the street with catering tables eating outdoors, doing basically the same thing that the business owners had been prohibited from doing. It's just absolutely crazy. Newsom has started with a bad idea and then applied it in ways that made it even worse. And whatever it is we learn from all of this, it's the first and easiest and clearest lesson is Gavin Newsom has fought COVID in a way that's terrible, and California style lockdowns don't work, and we shouldn't ever do them again.
Let's get to our listener question of the week, which extends our conversation here about COVID policy. Remember, you can send us your queries at via email at roundtable@reason.com. Or voicemail at 213-973-3017. Today's question comes from Justin, who writes, I hear there's a global pandemic, which apparently is killing hundreds of thousands of people, destroying economies, and generally driving people, particularly parents of school-aged kids, into a suboptimal state. Just curious, why is the FDA taking forever to approve vaccines? Justin continues, I assume the Biden, quote-unquote, relief bill is not providing us any relief from the FDA bureaucracy going forward. So what would you, august members of the table, which is both round and reasonable, suggest to replace the current vaccine approval process with something that would be more responsive to our current and future pandemic needs, while also being something a theoretical Congress might actually pass? Catherine.
First of all, I want to thank the writer for his use of suboptimal, which I also use in that way to mean absolutely horrific. And so, yes, thank you for popularizing that further. So there's a couple things we could do here. Most of this, I will put a disclaimer on it, is absolutely current crisis confirms my priors type analysis, because my priors were always that the FDA needs to speed up or get the hell out of the way. And you know, I will say the FDA, in terms of its role in vaccine approval, did better than I would have expected with this pandemic in some ways. Now, that is like put all the caveats on that fella, since obviously the FDA screwed the pooch 18 different ways. But it could have been a lot worse. And it is a lot worse in other places. The pace of vaccine approvals in, you know, civilized nations with largely regulated or bureaucratic health apparatuses are not great around the world. So I do want to grade us on that curve, I suppose. But I think the most interesting thing here, and this is something that Ron Bailey will be writing about in the next issue of the magazine, is that We made vaccines a new way this time. So the technology, mRNA technology, is not itself actually new. It's been around for a couple decades. We've been trying to use it for a bunch of stuff, including curing cancer. But it was uniquely well-suited to this problem, but it will be well-suited to making lots of new kinds of vaccines and other medical technologies in the near future. That technology specifically is subject to a kind of pre-approval. And that is the place where I would say we could do a concrete, specific reform of the FDA process that would make vaccine approval much, much faster and much, much cheaper. Basically, we can approve. The way to think about it is that an mRNA-based vaccine is like a plug-and-play platform. So we could approve the underlying technology of the thing and then tweak it slightly based on the specific viral threat or whatever it is that we are looking to address, and move that then quickly through. Now, of course, the other thing I want to say is right to try and human challenge trials and anything where a person is voluntarily sticking out their arm and saying, like, put the needle in there. I am for that. I mean, truly everything I am for, but like, I recognize the world is not necessarily with me on the most extreme version of that answer. I do think a lot of people are with me, though, on the less extreme version of that answer, that we could, you know, it is well known at this point, I think, that we had the vaccine formulations, which are now being approved and being disseminated, in many cases, you know, a week or two after coronavirus was widely identified as a threat. It was incredible. It was an incredible feat of scientific discovery and engineering. And then we had to wait months for approval. Now, some of the reason we had to wait months was because of bad bureaucracy. Some reason, though, was because that's how we do it. We got to test stuff on people and wait to see if they die. And we could have speeded up that process hugely by allowing people in the population to volunteer to be part of human trials much, much earlier. That should be legalized. That should be more widely deregulated. And it could prevent, you know, Ron Bailey's thesis in the next issue of the magazine is that along with a bunch of other technologies, including treatments for viral infections, we don't have a broad spectrum antiviral right now, really, in the way that we have broad spectrum antibacterials. And there's some ways to deal with that. But that is such a big piece of never having to do this again. And it will be an absolute dereliction of duty if the FDA doesn't at least step back on a couple of those places and allow vaccines to be tested and disseminated more quickly.
Amen. Also, we're going to fix malaria, I keep seeing.
This week there's this cool headline that was like, oh, by the way, this thing that we use to build the COVID vaccines looks like maybe we can use it on malaria, which is baller. Like, great work. I mean, there's also, I will say, like, other good malaria news just independently. I went looking after.
Wow, good malaria news is not a three-word phrase you hear often.
I'm glad I held on to the stock.
El Salvador became the first country in Central America to be categorized as malaria-free by the WHO this week. They just did that. They did it the old-fashioned way. They just eradicated malaria through
death squads.
They killed nuns. Yeah. There is the age divide. That. If you remember the 80s, you remember death squads.
They worked on this for 50 years to eradicate malaria, and they should be congratulated. But wouldn't it be amazing if we could work on this
next up,
for
communism.
5 months, build a vaccine and disseminate it globally? Yeah. That is a real possibility in the coming year if regulators don't screw it up.
Another major kind of meta thing to think about with the lesson that we should be taking away from this is we need to decentralize authorities that allow people to act in meaningful ways. And the FDA, you know, presented itself along with the CDC, but in many ways, the FDA is even worse, just as a bottleneck for all sorts of information and experimentation and innovation. And I am not sanguine at all that anything will change. But if we need one more example of what happens when you centralize power and control and information in a particular part of the government or within a particular corporation that is not subject to, you know, market forces and competition, you get what we had here, which is just an awful, awful thing. And it's not just about COVID. You know, thinking back, when was the Dallas Buyers Club? You know, when did that come out? That movie is a fantastic critique of the mindset that gives rise or that inhabits the FDA and a lot of people in America. You know, there is no sense of urgency in the FDA. We are in a pandemic, a once in our lifetime pandemic, of that I'm pretty confident. And they are still like, well, you know what? Like, it's 5 o'clock. We gotta, you know, take the weekend off now because, you know, we can't be working overtime on stuff like that. It's just a disaster. There's other things like, you know, they can get rid of the efficacy requirement of new drugs, and instead just talk about effective or about safety, so that people can experiment more. They could recognize approvals in foreign countries or in places like the EU, associations like the EU, that we will accept every other declaration that they say this is good or works. There's any number of things that we could and should be doing. And the question is, how do you bring that energy to bear on actual lawmakers who are, they don't give a shit. I mean, they really don't. They got their vaccines and they stay in power.
Peter, is there anything in the American Rescue Plan that speaks at all to FDA procedures?
Not really. Only about 1% of that spending is devoted directly to vaccination. And that's mostly just sort of infrastructure, getting the rollout set up. But just to sort of ping off what Nick and Catherine said, I think there are a couple of things that you could do. I don't know how politically possible they are, but they seem like the sort of things that shouldn't be politically impossible. So in an emergency, what you need is flexibility and nimbleness. And that's exactly what the FDA and the CDC don't have, right? They're just sort of, they are inherently bureaucratically inflexible. And so we end up with a situation where in the UK, AstraZeneca is approved. And no one really thinks that it's unsafe to take it, right? There's even the people who are like, oh, well, you know, we've got to respect the FDA process here. They're not defending the idea that the AstraZeneca vaccine is somehow dangerous. They're just defending the notion that the FDA process is so important that we've got to, that we should delay this, the approval here for 2 or 3 more months. It's absolutely crazy. And again, it shows this sort of slavish devotion to bureaucratic processes that are serving us really badly. The same thing goes for the first doses first movement, which the UK adopted, right? And so what you see with all of these two-dose vaccines, the first two vaccines that got approved are both two-dose vaccines. One is 3 weeks apart, one is 4 weeks apart. The first dose, after 2 or 3 weeks, should give you something like 80 or 85% immunity, or sort of on average, about 80 or 85% of people are not going to get significant symptoms of COVID, right? And yet we're not prioritizing just getting as many people up to that 80 or 85% level as possible. Instead, we're sticking with a second dose regime, mainly because that's how the paperwork was filed with the FDA. And the FDA doesn't have a procedure in place, doesn't have the ability to conceive of changing the approval kind of in midstream. And initially I thought, oh, well, you know, it wasn't tested for the first doses and we haven't figured that out. And I was a little more sympathetic, I think, maybe a couple of months ago when the vaccines first were approved, to the idea that probably we should stick with the process they tested. But it's now very clear at this point in March that a single dose of those vaccines provides a significant amount of immunity, and the FDA just can't figure out what to do with that information. And you look at something like the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that was approved, it has basically the same level of immunity protection, right? Around 80 or 85% after one dose. And the FDA approved that because that's how the paperwork came in. And so the FDA is just incredibly inflexible and not nimble in ways that I think are dangerous to public health.
And this is also a great example of what I was saying earlier, that if we had just earlier in the process let a bunch of people try these, we would have known this first dose thing so much sooner. This was a knowable piece of information that could have been gotten for quite low risk from a relatively small pool that was just not allowable as part of the process, and it could be.
Yeah, I would just add onto the challenge trials thing that Catherine brought up. Challenge trials are difficult because of the ethical concerns. And the ethical concern is not just that you're letting people sign up to get the vaccine tested on them. It is that you are deliberately infecting a group of people with the coronavirus along with vaccine, right? And that tells you, you know how many people were exposed to it. You know immediately, so you can do it with a much smaller group, right? And the results are in some ways much more clear pretty quickly. But you're deliberately exposing people to a virus that could be deadly. And you've also got to use a control in that situation, right? So it's ethically complicated for some people. On the other hand, every single person who is getting involved is doing it of their own volition. They're doing it by choice. And if you can combine challenge trials with mRNA technology, you can have brand new vaccines rolled out in half the time.
Of the already record-setting small amount of time. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's just amazing to think about. We had this basic vaccine technology in either January or February, and we just had to take 8 or 9 months, whatever it was, to test it. And you could speed up those
tests. Thanksgiving weekend,
right?
Yeah, we had to take Thanksgiving weekend off.
I mean, that's another
actual small thing the FDA could do is they could do a rolling paperwork review. Again, the UK does this, but instead what the FDA does is they wait for everything to be finished and then they take a week or two to review the paperwork. And 2 weeks after, you know, the company files for approval.
It should be making everybody in America blow their stack and be livid. And I'll go so far as to say, you know, the 21st century, a world in which we acknowledge and inhabit and kind of embrace the idea that we need to decentralize and disperse information, knowledge, autonomy, it can't begin until you get rid of monuments to a dead understanding of how information, medicine, corporate power, all of this stuff works. You know, it's a dead legacy from mid-century 20th century, from an old American century, and it kills people. You know, that everybody agrees that when you look at the cost-benefit analysis of FDA approval, and it's not simply in the pandemic, it's, you know, just regular order of business, it kills more people than it saves. And that should be something that gets people very upset. Matt, I see you are smug because you have your vaccine. You can go running around. You know,
I'm licking doorknobs in Port Authority now.
Yeah, no, it is just like, so you're back to your pre-pandemic behavior. But it should be, this is the type of thing which is like the deep grammar of power and of government power that we need to somehow like push up to the surface and really expose and get people pissed about. Because in the end, this is even more important than stuff over, you know, whether or not the federal government is going to raise the minimum wage to $15, which would be stupid. But this, you know, this is like a deep tissue massage that is just is killing people and will continue to for, you know, as long as the FDA and its current
iteration.
That is
how I feel about
says.
Massage, I'm not sure the...
I am going for the mixed metaphors on massage.
Is it the small of Catherine's back or... Let's do a quick one-hitter at the end here. I just wanted to say out loud that last week, Thursday even... Joe Biden lobbed 7 500-pound bombs in eastern Syria himself in the general direction of Iranian-backed militias.
So when he won the election, right? Even the Republicans will say that's when he became president.
True.
Thank you for stepping on my line, Gillespie. The militias
send
have been firing.
Send a telegram next time, Matt. It'll be quicker.
Yeah, that's true. Anyways, this... seemed to contradict statements that during the Trump administration, Kamala Harris had said, Biden had said, even Jen Psaki had said, I hope that's how you pronounce her name, because that's how I'm going to for the rest of my life. Catherine, obviously, Biden finally became president. They said in response to what the legal authority is, the president took this action pursuant to his Article 2 authority to defend U.S. personnel. Do you want to give a quick reflection on how this makes you feel, Catherine?
I really, really try not to ever enjoy other people's disillusionment about politics if I don't think it's going to affect change. But I have had, I will say, a little bit of unpleasant but real enjoyment of this week's broad-based lefty disillusionment with Biden, right? Like, the Syria thing was a huge part of it. It was like, oh, no, he's doing the wars just like Trump did the wars, but we can't really admit that. And what are we going to do? But also, I mean, the $15 minimum wage basically died. Student loan forgiveness is not happening or happening much smaller. By the way, White House visitor logs are not being really released. By the way, your coronavirus checks are a lot smaller than you thought they were going to be. Like, Biden is a lame status quo institutionalist, and that includes his foreign policy. And everyone should have known that that was what was going to happen. And we had to hype ourselves up so much. Not we. The left had to hype itself up so much to get behind the election of Joe Biden because it felt like the most important thing in the world. And maybe it was. I don't know. Trump was extremely bad. But the level of lying to themselves that had to be done around foreign policy and so many other things, like, that was all going to come due. And here it is this week, especially coming due.
All right, let's go to our end of show consumption. I'm going to lead off because not really even to talk too much about what I've watched, but just to make that rare acknowledgement that I think I'm caught up on a current program that the people in the country are all talking about.
And that, but you just called it a program, so that zeroed out your currentness?
I would usually call it the program, which is even better. But yeah, WandaVision, which is geared up. It had its penultimate episode a couple of days ago. And Marvel Comic Universe, sort of famously set in the, with Scarlet Witch and the Vision. After the snap, it's all sitcoms, it's weird, it's fun, enjoy it. And I don't know if the rest of you all have been catching up on it. I preferred the first half of the 8 episodes that I've watched just because there is a wrong-footedness of it. You're trying to figure out what the hell is going on, and I enjoyed that feeling more than knowing what was going on, but it's still it's an interesting wrinkle in a surprisingly durable anti-Scorsese cinematic accomplishment of the past 20 years. Suderman, what did you watch, and/or do you want to talk?
Can we talk about WandaVision a little bit? Because it's setting itself up for the most unsatisfying conclusion since Lost or Poe's narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym. I suspect that when this series ends, Peter, correct me as you will, but there will be a rash of broken TVs and or whatever screen devices dedicated viewers of WandaVision are watching the conclusion, the finale on. It's really, I think it's jumped the shark.
I mean, I'm actually behind on it. This may be the first time in history that Matt Welch is further ahead in the Marvel universe than I am. So I don't know about where it's going, but it does sound like it's going to be a great stimulus for OLED manufacturers if everybody ends up breaking their TVs.
Maybe that Foxconn plant will finally get up and running.
Krugman cut. Suderman, what have you been watching?
I've been catching up on the television show The Expanse, which is now on Amazon Prime. It used to run on the Sci-Fi Channel. It was canceled. And then Jeff Bezos, who is a giant nerd and like just kind of interesting, was like, hey, that's a good show. I like science fiction. We need a good science fiction show. Let's bring it over to Amazon. And so the last couple seasons have aired on Amazon, and the show has only gotten better in the process. I think it started good, and then in seasons 3, 4, and especially 5, which just finished a couple of weeks ago, the show has just gotten really, really, it's just so satisfying to watch in a kind of classic way that doesn't also feel somehow sort of retro or old school. It's based on a series of novels by the a pair of authors who are writing under the name of James S. A. Corey. And it's a sci-fi show about humans expanding beyond the solar system. So it starts with a colonized solar system, and then shows how we expanded beyond the solar system into the galaxy, right? And so the sort of the underlying pitch for this show was, hey, we've seen a lot of shows about a colonized or stories about a future in which humans have colonized the solar system. And we've seen a lot of stories about a future in which humans have colonized the galaxy. We've seen almost no stories about the transition from one to the other and how we managed to escape that galaxy. And this is a series that is about that and about that process. But it's also a series about politics. And so it revolves around three main factions, the Earthers, the Martians, and the Belters. And it's just so interestingly driven by coalition and faction politics. And it's incredibly refreshing to see a show that is really smart and interesting about how people go about political conflict, right? About how that sort of manifests and how it works, that doesn't in any way feel like it is litigating today's political conflicts, right? It's not that it's totally unrelated to today's political conflicts, but it's just like, it's not about the 2016 election at all. It's not about like DCCC politics versus the Bernie Bros or anything like that. It's about, like, here's a different world. Here's a future that has evolved from one that we have, you know, that one that we recognize. And they have a different politics than we do, but it still operates under some of the same kind of essential human impulses, which is that people want power, people want profit, people want to sort of gather forces, you know, behind them. They want independence. They want freedom. They also, you know, sort of want control. And it's just a really interesting, really smartly plotted show. Highly recommended for anybody who likes high-end genre, whether it's fantasy or science fiction stuff. It has become one of my favorite shows on television.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I read a John Le Carré novel, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. Read it at the behest of a book club. I would not have read it otherwise. In many ways, my anti-Le Carré bias was vindicated. This book is just an excruciating display of high-status men doing stupid man things for status in a way that I found not enlightening to read, because I already knew that that happens, but instead somewhat painful. However, I will say I grudgingly concede that the man can write. That was a good read. It made me turn the pages, as they say. And I had not realized this is, I think, his third book. It was written, I think, sort of concurrent with his, it was his big bestseller, but his third book. My edition had a 50 years later preface in which John Le Carré grouches about how no one will believe him when he says that he wasn't really, really like a real spy. And how annoying that is. And I thought that was actually pretty interesting, right? That then what his claim, which sounds right to me, is, listen, I was working for intelligence services at the time that I wrote this, and they approved its publication because it's purely fiction. Like, that is evidence that this book doesn't contain the deep truth of my spy service. I was demonstrably employed by intelligence agencies, and they let me publish this garbage. So I thought that was an interesting little twist. Also had not realized previously that the cynicism about the role of spies is very, very deeply embedded in these books themselves, right? That all the characters are not, they are all anti-heroes. Everyone is an anti-hero. Everybody is bad. And this one, I guess, technically is a George Smiley novel, which is a whole thing unto itself that I don't really appreciate because I've not really read other Le Carré, but
the best way to appreciate George Smiley is to watch the old BBC adaptation of Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, which is an early kind of miniseries, like a long narrative miniseries of the type that we now see today that is just so good.
But I will say that the sort of very on-the-nose conversation between a sort of spy versus spy conversation in which they both agree that the thing they are doing is amoral at best, immoral most likely.
It's just a game.
It doesn't actually help anyone and perhaps just makes it all worse. Like, that I didn't fully expect and kind of appreciated to find there. So John Le Carré, I don't know if you've heard of him.
Le Carré is
a pretty good writer.
Ponce de Leon of It's Just a Game, which is such a disgusting, cynical Cold War attitude by a player from a country that had been unseated from the peak of actually exercising power. In the French and the English, you see this again and again, because let's be cynical about power now that we can no longer wield it in full force. It's a great book, and there's also a great movie version from, I think, like 1965 or 66 with Richard Burton that is... it does justice to the book, I think.
Nick.
Yes, I watched what I was consumed with last week is a documentary about the economist and social critic Thomas Sowell, called Thomas Sowell, Common Sense in a Senseless World. It's from the Free to Choose Network, the people who put together the Milton Friedman and Rose Friedman series, as well as a variety of other great programming. It is hosted by Jason Riley, who's at the Manhattan Institute and a columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Sowell is a really interesting thinker for, you know, of the past 50 or 60 years. He's written a lot about race. He is Black, and his biography is fascinating. He grew up poor, very poor during the Depression in North Carolina and in Harlem. Ended up getting his PhD when he was 38 years old, a true late starter, but really came out of the blocks fast in the early 70s. He's written, his writings on race and culture are fascinating, where he has a famous critique of the bell curve, while he also believes that culture matters, you know, massively. But he, for this audience, he might be most interesting for his two books, one called Knowledge and Decisions, which is takes Friedrich Hayek's kind of conception of knowledge and markets and dispersed and decentralized information in a famous essay about the use of knowledge in society. And he does a book-length treatment of that to show how it's really hard for elites or experts or people who want to control stuff just to have the information necessary to make decent decisions, whereas it resides among people who are generally looked down upon by elites or powerful people. He's got a great book called The Conflict of Visions, where he maps out two incompatible views of kind of human nature and society and the role of institutions. Are you a utopian or a believer in an unconstrained vision where essentially, if you can dream it, you can force it into human society and perfect people, or a constrained vision, which is more allied with a kind of classical liberal understanding where you want people to try and improve their lives, but you create institutions that limit the amount of power or the amount of terrible things that people can do to one another in government, in the economy, and all sorts of things. And there's also a great Reason essay, which Jason Riley also has a forthcoming biography of Sol that's coming out called Maverick, which he tells me was inspired by reading the great history of T.R.M. Howard, another kind of Black figure in post-war America. But in that book, he talks a lot about a December 1980 interview of Thomas Sowell by Tom Hazlett, a longtime contributor to Reason, and Manny Klausner, one of the founding editors of Reason. December 1980, I think it's available definitely to subscribers, but also I think to people just trolling through our archives. It's a fascinating conversation about a guy who is not particularly libertarian in his personal and social commitments. Sowell will always say, libertarian comes closest to defining me, and here are 1,000 reasons why libertarians are idiots. But his vision, his epistemology is fundamentally libertarian. So I would watch Thomas Sowell, Common Sense in a Senseless World. It's free on YouTube. It's an excellent intro, and then dig into his basic economics book, and now in its 5th edition, Knowledge and Decisions and a Conflict of Visions.
Awesome. That's all the common sense we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Thank y'all for listening. Check out all of our podcasty stuff at reason.com/podcasts, including but not limited to the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie on Wednesday. And also the Soho Forum tend to be on Fridays as well. Thank you. See you next Monday.